Hello, and welcome to Series 2 of The Good Stuff, a podcast from The Wheel that brings you news, views, and inspiring voices from the Irish non-profit sector. I'm Emily Burke, and over the next three episodes, I'll be talking to leaders from the sector about resilience during the COVID-19 crisis. In this first episode, I spoke with Peter McBride, Director of the Cohen Centre for Holocaust Studies, and Stephanie Manahan, CEO of the Central Remedial Clinic, about their perspectives on resilience. What it is, is it a useful concept, and how does it apply to their own work right now? Because of COVID-19, I obviously wasn't able to invite them to the studio with me, but thanks to the wonders of technology, they were able to join me virtually. I caught up with Peter McBride first.
So my name is Peter McBride. I am just about to take up a new role for me, which is as the director of a place called the Cohen Centre for Holocaust and Genocide Studies, which is over in the States. It's in New Hampshire. It's one of the oldest Holocaust organisations that has been around. And I hope to be there fairly soon. With the current travel ban, that's put a little bit of a question mark over when exactly we'll be able to be there. My history, I've worked in Ireland all of my life, most of my life. Most latterly, for about the last 20 years in the voluntary sector, I was the chief executive of an organisation called Inspire. As part of my role in Inspire originally, I set up a part of Inspire called CareCall, which was looking particularly at mental health in the workplace. Inspire is a mental health organisation. So I look particularly at mental health in the organisation. I come from a kind of a mental health therapeutic background. I'd worked in bereavement care. I'd become interested in how trauma affects bereavement, how it affects people's mental health, and then came into the world of Inspire, which was a mental health organisation, set up CareCall, and then about 10 years ago became chief executive of the whole organisation. It became quite large, all-Ireland organisation providing mental health services, workplace wellbeing services, and intellectual disability services.
Now, I know when we've spoken so far, you've said you don't consider yourself an especially resilient person, but I wonder what you would consider a resilient person to be.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because I think the terminology of resilience for me is not black and white. So having worked in this field for many, many years, you know, I've seen circumstances which are intolerable, actually, either in the workplace or personally. And when people talk about resilience in those circumstances, sometimes those who are suffering can hear it as a kind of catch yourself on, or, you know, you need to be stronger, rather than this situation is intolerable and, you know, the way you're reacting actually is quite appropriate. So I'll put that caveat in at the start. Resilience is not always the right response. Sometimes the response is system change or circumstance change. And sometimes people feeling broken and suffering is actually the most appropriate human response in a situation. And that's a nice segue, I suppose, into into my own story with this, where I think I have to acknowledge that for whatever reason, and I think it's part of my personality, I find myself attracted to these kind of big issues. You know, there's something about suffering, both my own and other people's, that connects me in some way with what it means to be human. So, you know, I want to put that up front. I don't see myself as some kind of, as being particularly able to help other people, but I do count myself the kind of person who is prepared to suffer with, which is, I've used the word compassion in the past, and I'll talk about that a bit later on, but compassion means to suffer with. Literally, it means to suffer with. So when we talk about resilience, we talk about the kind of work that I've done in the past, which has been a whole variety of working with people who are suffering either with mental illness or with experience of abuse or with historic issues, then part of the challenge of that is I firmly believe that if you're going to be effective in doing that work, you have to allow yourself to be affected by it. So in a way, you have to suffer with people in order for them to feel that you can truly empathize with them and listen to and understand the pain that they're experiencing. So resilience is about, I think, allowing yourself, or being able to allow yourself to suffer, allow yourself to feel hurt, allow yourself to feel pain, and to have a confidence behind that you will recover, and in fact that the people that you are working with can recover. Whatever recovery looks like, actually, and you know, I don't mean fixing things or making it all better. But I do mean that there is, that the resilience is not about not suffering, and it is certainly not about fixing things. Resilience is about being able to suffer and understand that suffering is part of the human condition, and that if we have the privilege of walking with someone through their suffering, then we suffer with them, and we do so in the knowledge and hope and the belief, I suppose, that there is a brighter future ahead, that there is some kind of recovery, and that things will be better in the future.
Do you think that's complicated when your job is to kind of fix things? And as it kind of feels right now, many structures are kind of crumbling around us. There are so many uncertainties. Does that complicate the idea of resilience?
It does. It does. It complicates it incredibly. I mean, I for many years in my early career, I trained counsellors, I trained therapists. And one of the real challenges was dealing with people whose quite lovely instinct was to fix. You know, and part of the challenge, and this is so you got to remember that there's something about the distinction between a therapeutic environment where fixing is not the, you know, it's in a way it's not on the table. It is about how you work with someone to find a new way for them of being, and sometimes for them just living with the pain that they're experiencing. When you broaden that out in the way that you've described, I think there is a real challenge with it, because you know, we need solutions for a lot of the sort of organizational challenges, cultural challenges and social challenges that we have around us. We need solutions. We need practical solutions. And that's why, you know, I think, you know, the model, which is a therapeutic model, starts to break down when you take it into those settings. And in fact, you know, I mean, I talk to a lot of people and about this sort of thing. And I think that having an understanding of human psychology, understanding the importance of suffering, is about the nature of human relationships. That is quite distinct from the kind of structural and systemic challenges that we face. So I've worked in the voluntary sector all my life. I was a senior manager, as the chief executive of an organization. I had to make some really tough decisions that affected people's lives. You know, they affected people's incomes. They affected how they paid their mortgage. They affected their job security. I never took those decisions lightly. I always, in a way, I kind of felt, I hope I felt the pain. I felt the pain of having to make those kind of decisions, but I made those decisions. And so you start to see here some of the tension between. So I think, I suppose throughout all my life, I've experienced this kind of fundamental tension between the impulse to have relationships with people, to be caring, to be compassionate, to, you know, the prioritization of relationships, and then the pressures of work, the pressure of management, the pressure of having to run a system or run an organization where, you know, everybody is not always happy. You cannot always be, you know, just prioritize individuals. You have to kind of take a holistic view of what is good for the organization. And sometimes individuals within that will either not like it or it won't be good for them. And I think that with the coronavirus, with COVID-19, I think that it's put organizations under incredible pressure, incredible stress. And therefore the systemic challenges, the systemic decisions that need to be made will hurt some people, because it won't be necessarily in their own individual interests, but in the interests of the organization.
Both as a person and as a leader of an organization, are there ways that you, I suppose, keep yourself going during those times?
Yeah, there are. And one of the most important things is, I think that everybody in a leadership role should have a philosophy, for want of a better description. You need to have a set of beliefs that you stick to that help you make sense of life and that help you make sense of your role. So, you know, we talk about organizational values, and the organizational values are really important. Personal values or a personal philosophy for helping you remain stable during all the different kinds of decisions that you have to make. I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting when you look around at the leadership in the world at the minute, and I don't want to be specific about this, but you know, you can tell the main leaders that are around of large countries, what there is in some of them is an absolute lack of consistency. There is no, you get the sense that there's no core set of beliefs or values or morals even that are the wellspring from which the decision making process happens. So, you know, when you are a leader in difficult situations, you have to draw on something within yourself that gives you confidence about knowing what the right thing to do is, as far as in your own heart you can make that decision. Because you know that the decision is going to have negative repercussions for some, positive for others, who knows? So you have to have something within yourself that you can connect with and mobilize that allows you to have confidence that you are trying to do the right thing, trying to make the right decision, whatever that may be. And that when you wrestle with that and, you know, take advice and talk to people and try and work it all through, when you finally come to a point where you're making those decisions, that you have the confidence that, you know, you're in a way your conscience is clear, you're trying to do the right thing, difficult as it may be. So that thing is very important, Emily, that people have a philosophy. I've studied a lot of theology, philosophy. I became interested recently in Stoicism, which is an ancient Greek philosophy that's finding resurgence. And there's really interesting books on this now, just about a modern version of that. How do we engage in a world where largely most of what we are engaging with, we have no control over? Mm-hmm. You know, they're very, actually in the real world, there's very little that we have control over. But what we do have control over is ourselves and our own choices. And how we feel, actually, we have a degree of control over. So, you know, you start with that. Start with your own philosophy. Start with your own values. Start with your own moral framework, your own conceptual framework, and then build on that to make decisions. And then stick by the conclusions you come to, understanding that they are in the very difficult situations, probably the best that you can come up with, and have a degree of humility about that as well.
When you're in a position of leadership, you have a certain amount of control over decisions, at least. And I imagine that one of the challenges then, if you're trying to foster an atmosphere of, or that promotes resilience in your staff as well, how might you do that?
So the language I would use in this is the language of compassionate leadership. So what does that mean? It means that when you're faced with all these sort of important, high-level technical decisions that need to be made, the primary lens that you view them through is relational. It is not technical, it's relational. So it is understanding that businesses are run by people, that services are delivered by people, that success is created by people, and that business decisions or organizational decisions need to be understood or made through the lens of people, of the human experience. And compassion is about it. So going back to my original definition of it, suffering with people, it is understanding that those decisions, it is viewing them through the lens of how those decisions will impact on individuals and groups within the organization, and allowing yourself to be affected by that. So my experience in life has always been that even where I've had to make really, really difficult decisions, if people understand that it hurts me to do it, or that it costs me to do it, or that I don't do it glibly, or that I have struggled with it, and, you know, I have suffered with it, and it is the only conclusion that I can see that we come to, then my experience with people is that feels a bit better. I mean, it doesn't make it better, but I think that when people understand that it's not just a cold-hearted somebody somewhere with a set of numbers and ticking boxes somewhere, but that there is passion in it and there's humanity in it, and there is a genuine effort to take people's feelings and needs into account and to avoid hurt, then I think it feels very different. And when it comes to this in organisations, you know, I've done a lot of work with a lot of very different organisations, and you can tell the difference. You can tell the difference walking into an organisation where the management and leadership are caring for their staff. People behave differently. They perform differently. They talk differently to organisations where it's command and control, and, you know, it's here's your set of objectives and that's what you do and just get on with it and report back to me. It doesn't work. What works is when people are motivated and mobilised. That's what you get: better performance, you get better compliance, you get all the things that are important for a successful business come from that. So cold, hard rationalism, in my view, just, you know, honestly, I'm just not sure it works. What is the point of life? You know, if you kind of get very philosophical about this, what is the point in life? Well, it is for you to have a happy and content population, happiness. And we lose sight of that all the time. We think, you know, we go look to lower level things like money or security or all those things and forget that actually the point of life is happiness. Fundamentally, that's what most of us are looking for.
A lot of organisations right now, particularly in the charity and voluntary sector, they're worried about what the future holds. What would be the main advice that you would have for organisations over the coming months in this kind of situation?
Because the world around us has changed so much, one of the things that charities need to do is go right back to basics and think again about what their core purpose is, what their core vision is, and how in this new dispensation they as an organization need to engage with that. And the tough decisions will be around what kind of infrastructure they need to do that, you know, the number of staff they need to employ, whether they use volunteers or not, what they can afford to do. But, you know, the voluntary sector is at its best whenever it is value driven, whenever it is vision driven by a cause, by the thing that it is, those organizations are trying to change about society. And I think that, you know, when you become a charity that becomes a big business, it's possible to lose that. So one of the things that we need to kind of come back to is why are we doing this anyway? And what if we are if we're clear about our core purpose, our core vision, then what is the version of that now that needs to exist in this new world that we are coming into, where things have changed really substantially? We're heading into an economic depression. You know, people are scared. There is social attitudes have changed. The most vulnerable are even more vulnerable. So what should our organization look like? And I suppose the real challenge in that will be, are we prepared to fundamentally change? Are we really prepared to change? Or are we going to try and cling on to something that was relevant, you know, 6 months ago, or maybe a year ago or a couple of years ago, but frankly is just not relevant now because the world has changed so much? And I suppose I am filled with hope about this, because I do believe that our sector, more than any, is capable of change. It's capable of flexing itself, of flipping from one focus to the next really, really quickly. Then the thing to do is to take a deep breath, get right back to basics. Why are we here? What is it that we're trying to achieve? And what do we need to look like now in order to achieve that? You know, when we talk about resilience, in the way that I describe resilience, the voluntary sector is perfect for it. It is exactly the place where value should come first, people come first, and trying to help and be humane and human is the lens through which we do things. So I think I'm hopeful that this actually, while it is going to be painful, you know, we will survive it and we will come through and thrive. And there is a real need for a really important conversation within a whole of society about what our values are. How should we treat people who are marginalized? How do we treat people who are vulnerable? Because the voluntary sector is providing all those services and doing all this work in there. And I'm not sure that the rest of society particularly understands that or really understands the depth and sophistication of work that is going on. So this experience, this crisis that we've had with coronavirus, it has created a situation where I think for the first time in my life, there's a possibility of having that conversation. And I would argue that the impetus for that needs to come from us. So we as a sector need to start to create the opportunities for our societies to have those conversations and to plan together what the future is going to look like. Because the one thing we can be sure about this is the future is not going to look like the way it was. It is going to be different. So we have an opportunity to plan that, to create it, to co-design it, if you like, with the rest of society in a kind of a big conversation about where we're going and what we want to achieve.
Well, I think that's a really nice, hopeful note to end on. So thank you so much for your time, Peter. Really appreciated the conversation. Thank you.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
After speaking with Peter, I was keen to ask our next guest, Stephanie Manahan, about how the idea of resilience might be impacting her work in a practical way right now.
I'm Stephanie Manahan. I'm the chief executive of the CRC. The CRC is a national charity that specialises in physical disability and also manages and supports people with much broader disability as well. We have most of our locations in and around the Dublin region. However, we also have services and supports down in Waterford and in Limerick. And we actually work with children from every single county in Ireland. And we have quite a broad spectrum of services, from medical through to social care, educational. We're also the trustees of two special education schools that between them educate about 150 children. So we're a very busy organisation. We're a complex little organisation, and we might even be reflecting on the challenges that complexity can present at times of difficulty.
So I wonder, for anyone listening who might not be familiar with it, could you give us a bit of background on the time you joined the CRC? Because it was a difficult time for the organisation.
It was indeed, Emily. It was a very challenging time, and certainly in sort of the late summer, autumn, and then the winter of 2013, the CRC was catapulted into really the national psyche in the worst way possible as for a charity and for an organization. There was a massive sort of catastrophic failure in governance, really, in the organization. And I think it's really important to see how governance and failure in governance can virtually bring an organization such as the CRC almost to the brink of destruction. So that resulted in the organization establishing a new board in 2014, employing a new CEO. And really, we set about at an extraordinary pace, really, a significant framework for change. The organization had been established back in 1951. It is a terrific organization. It has volunteerism and at its core. And it was really, really important to the board and to myself to re-establish and put the organization back to where it rightly should have sat. The services, the care for the adults with disabilities and the children with disabilities was second to none. And I think it's really important that the psychological contract at the time between the organization and its staff, between the organization and the clients, between the organization and its supporters, its funders, was completely shattered. So we had an enormous task, really, to re-establish those trusting relationships. Indeed, it rocked, I suppose, not only the CRC, but it rocked actually the charity and the Irish, I suppose, discussions at the time. It sent all charities, I suppose, back to the dark recesses of their own organisations. And governance became an extraordinary buzzword. And I think that if one was to look at any positive out of it at all, and I think it's important from a resilience point of view to look at positives, it did herald an extraordinary development in governance across the entire charity sector for Ireland. And I think that has been a massive positive, because I am so proud of the governance and the striving for governance across the entire sector. And of course, I'm exceptionally proud of the CRC. And if I was to talk about the resilience through that, the CRC in itself, it has its own personality, it's its own being in many ways, and it is more resilient than the rest of us. And I think that there's a lesson in that, that the organization has survived, and the organization will survive all of us. And it's our job and our duty in our professions, and indeed in our sector, to protect the organizations and the work that they do. Because, of course, by protecting the organization, you're protecting the good work that they do across the sector. And I think that there's a lesson in learning from that as well, in resilience and in surviving that, for sure.
You know, you talk about having to undergo massive scale change at the time. It is something that a lot of organizations are going to be grappling with in the near future. Would you have advice for organizations who, or leaders, particularly in organizations, who are grappling with the prospect of large scale change?
Absolutely. And if I was to give advice, I've led, I suppose, the organization through an extraordinary time this last 17 weeks. And I would have to say that the success is completely down to the incredible staff that have come with me on this journey. I do think there's some key lessons and some key reflections about what really went well and how did we do that? Because in addition to virtually within a very short period of time, reinventing our services completely, we also managed to successfully redeploy over 110 staff to a variety of other very critical areas within the health and social care sector. And if I'm to describe maybe some of the key elements of what made that work and how we managed to do that, I think the first thing was, as a leader, about articulating the vision. I was very clear from day one that we had a responsibility to deliver and to support our services, that we were not closing our doors. We had a duty to support our services, our clients, and to support our fellow organizations in this crisis. And I have to say, Emily, what was extraordinary about this time where more than any other time before, we've all been separated, we've been so fragmented, we've been all over the place. The feedback to me is that people have never felt so connected to the organization. And I think there's a massive lesson in that for a CEO, but also for all CEOs and all organizations. And that has been precious, really. I've got some amazing feedback of how people felt that communication was critical. I think the next piece was about supporting then the staff. So supporting all of the staff in across locations. It was about making sure that they were safe and they were secure. And we also were very keen, I suppose, to recognize people. So one of the initiatives that I attached to the daily update is we created this amazing storyline of a day in the life. So I went out to staff and I said, send me a day in the life, no matter what you're doing, so that you can tell everybody about what your day is. I was flooded with the most extraordinary stories. They're basically an archive for the future of how we survived COVID. Well, we're not through it yet, but how we certainly survived the first crisis. And all of those stories we circulated. So whether it was from a redeployed location, whether it was somebody working from home, it was a whole variety of things from everybody in the organization. And so it was really, really, it was really connecting people. So we're through the crisis piece. We're now, of course, in almost a more massively more challenging space where we're building back up our services and setting targets for activity and performance. We've also encouraged team building. So now the teams are coming back together again, that they're actually taking time out to reconnect and to spend some time team building. So we're supporting that. I'm currently doing a series of meetings. So myself and the senior management team are doing a series of meetings with every department and every division and every location via Zoom to do a Q&A. Anything, there's nothing is off the agenda. And we basically set the scene that we will try and answer everything. And if we can't, we'll come back to them. So really, there's some of the key pieces that we've done to maintain the organization and to support the organization.
And do you find that the principles kind of underlying those key decisions and how you go about making those decisions, do you find that there's a set of underlying principles that helps you manage?
I grew up in West Cork, and my family now, we were in a village, but they've moved to Mizzenhead. But a very dominant feature when you live where I was is Fastnet. The Fastnet is out in the ocean, for anybody who's aware of the Fastnet Rock. You probably hear it on the weather reports. It's out on the ocean. And on a bad day and on a stormy day, you can't see it. On a really misty, foggy day, you can't see it, but you know it's there. And I suppose for me, on a sunny day and on a calm day and on a beautiful day, you can see it and it's crystal clear. And I suppose it's been a real part of my life. I always know that it's there. So I always have the horizon in my line of sight. And irrespective of how choppy the water is, how difficult times can be, I know and I believe in my very being that we'll get there. And I think if you can, as a leader, communicate that, and that you can communicate it with conviction, and people will trust, actually, you know where you're going, you know you've got it in your line of sight, that people will actually trust you and go with you on that journey. And I think that's, as a leader, that's the best that you can do. And being honest and being very clear about it. And I think that, and the fact that the stormy water, there'll be bad days. You won't get it all right. There will be challenges. But I think it's that conviction that you will actually get there. That's been one of the things that I have always felt has kind of navigated me through those choppy waters, those challenging times. And I think that's fair to say for an organization as well.
Actually, so that's a really nice image to lead me on to the next question, because so obviously I invited you on here to under the umbrella of talking about resilience. Do you think it is a useful concept and one that you would, I suppose, bear in mind when planning and something that you try to cultivate in your organization?
I do. And you know, and I think there's a lot of debate and discussion about resilience. I think we as a nation are quite a resilient nation. And I think it is in our DNA. Do I think we're all born with the same amount of it? No. But I do think it is something that we can nurture and we can develop. And I think it is about how we respond, perhaps, to situations. I think for me, one of the most important tools in developing resilience is knowing ourselves, is taking time to consider how we are maybe reacting rather than responding to a situation, how much toll it takes with us. We've all had those dark nights of the soul. And I think resilience isn't about being tough. And I think there's a, you know, there's a misconception out there that if you're resilient, you're tough, you can withstand everything. I'd like to cut through that. I don't think it's about being tough. I think it's actually about being emotionally intelligent. I think it's about being connected with being able to recognize when perhaps you are very stressed, recognizing that maybe you're reacting rather than responding. I do find a few little tools, and I know there's lots of debate out there. I think there's a lot out there around self-care and mindfulness and looking after oneself. I think it could be a little bit simpler, and I do think it's about reflection. I think journaling is actually a very useful tool. I know when I started in the CRC, I didn't realize I was journaling, but I was. I had some very stressful times, and so I started jotting them down for myself. And by jotting them down, you're giving yourself a bit of space almost from them, and you're able to stand back and reflect on them. And actually, interestingly enough, even how we managed COVID, I think so many of us originally took to, and certainly I did, I love cooking, that won't come as any surprise, but people took to baking, and I was baking to beat the band until I realized actually my trousers were starting to feel tighter. And so I switched, and I also realized actually this isn't only going to be a couple of weeks, this is here for a long haul. So I switched from baking to cooking in a more healthy way, and really sort of I'm harissing and chipotling now to beat the band. But I suppose what I'm trying to say is it's about looking after ourselves as well. I've actually started journaling again, not every day, but it's about taking that time out to reflect on something. How did I manage that? The ability to be able to say I got that wrong without beating yourself up. It's about I got it wrong, and I'm going to think about why I got it wrong in my own reflection. But do I need to put my hands up and tell somebody I got it wrong and be honest and say, listen, I'm sorry if that wasn't how you wanted that to go? And I think that's really important as well in being resilient. And also, I think it's important to know when we all need a break. We're going to be really, really busy for the rest of this year. So I think we need to take stock. We need to take time out, and we need to make sure that in order to lead resilient organizations and be resilient ourselves, we need to recognize, certainly at a leadership level, that we, our team and our people need to take breaks and need to make sure that we are set up and our tank is full to be able to take on the next 6 months, because this year is not over yet.
Well, that's brilliant, Stephanie. I think we're just about coming up on time. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And thank you very much for the words of wisdom.
Thanks, Emily. Thanks. Thank you so much. Bye.
A huge thanks to both Peter and Stephanie for taking the time to speak with me over the summer. We really hope that you, the listeners, have found food for thought in their reflections. If you're interested in more COVID-19 supports and resources for your own organisation, visit wheel.ie and click on the COVID-19 tab. We've got practical guides for returning to the workplace, fundraising and income guidance, and a free help desk service. We always love to hear your comments, questions, and ideas for future podcast guests. You can find The Wheel on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @the_wheel_IRL, or email me at emily@wheel.ie. Join us next time when we speak to Michelle Murphy from Social Justice Ireland and Claire Brophy from the Abortion Rights Campaign about the resilience of ideas and how we might start to enact positive social change in the wake of COVID-19. Thanks for listening.